Earlier today, at a special event at the Arts Council, Patricia Ford was announced as the 7th Laureate na n-Óg, Ireland's Children's Literature Laureate. Patricia, an award-winning children's author herself, takes up the position from the outgoing laureate, Áine Ní Ghlin. Patricia will hold the title until 2026. Delighted to be joined by Patricia now on the phone. Congratulations, Cogardicus, Erin Gay Dulcheas, Patricia. And I noticed that it is the Gaeilge that is very much there at the beginning of your motto. Sauli, Sauli is what you're telling us to do as Laureate na n-Óg. Explain that lovely term to us, Sauli, Sauli.
Well, Sauli, Sauli is imagine, imagine. And in English, I was calling it, making it up as we go along, which seemed to describe kind of my life, really. So I thought it was as good a theme as any to go with.
I guess it is, you know, I hear artists talking to me time and time again saying, you know, if you could keep yourself as a child, your imagination would possibly and your artistic ability would flourish much better as an adult. How do you go about that? Because that's what you will be trying to do, I suppose, is tap into children's imaginations and keep those imaginations active and living.
Yeah, I suppose really there's kind of two wells of inspiration. There's your own childhood. And if you're lucky enough to have children, maybe their childhood, and you're a witness to that. But then there's also the children you meet. And as a children's writer in Ireland, we're really lucky. We get to meet a lot of children. So, you know, you're in and out of schools and in and out of libraries doing events. And I often say, you know, people are paying me money to inspire children, but actually they inspire me just as much. And I wanted to bring that with me as well into the theme where I said, you know, I really wanted to bring together two of my favourite groups of people, children's writers and illustrators and children. And together, I think we inspire one another. And I think if you're going to write for children, you have to keep that little connection all the time with the children of now.
Is it a very different process, Patricia, to write a book for children or to write a book with adults in mind?
I think so. I haven't written books for adults, but I've written a bit of television for adults. And I think it is different, but only insofar as there are certain things that you have to remember. I mean, the cardinal sin writing for children is to write down to them. So you can't be thinking in your head, you know, well, now I'm writing to these little people and I'm going to do it differently. Your first instinct is to tell a story as well as you can. And I often would write that story as well as I could and then go back and see where, you know, there might be something that isn't quite suitable for children. It might be something that they wouldn't understand or they wouldn't have enough information to deal with that. I think the other thing is there has to be hope. Whereas you can write a very bleak story for adults with children, and this is only my own opinion, but I think there is a responsibility on you to leave them with hope. So I suppose that is a big difference.
And I guess bleak is different from dark, because we all know from reading to children that the dark tales and the gory tales and the ghoulish tales are, there's an aspect of that that children really love and tap into.
They adore it. And the more colour there is, the more they love it, you know. But I think that's a different thing. That darkness is a thing we all like, where you can be frightened, but you're willingly allowing yourself to be frightened. And children do that too. They're very happy to have you frighten them. But I think what you can't do is to leave them with no hope. For humans, I suppose, you know, because you're writing about human beings and life and how we experience it. So you don't want to leave them with a feeling of it's all going to be terrible.
You're a former chair, Patricia, of Children's Books Ireland. This was the national charity that champions every child's right to develop a love of reading. What sort of challenges are there in today's digital world and multi-broadcast platform, you know, all of those various activities that are at fingertips for children? What is the challenge for books specifically in that world?
Well, we know we have big competition. I think we know that they are being very well entertained by screens a lot of the time. I'm not totally against that either. I think there are lots of creative things happening on screens. But for books to compete, we just have to write great stories. And I think when we do that, we don't have any problem competing. Ireland boasts a great readership amongst young people. We still have great readers. And we will, out of that, I hope, have great writers. because I said it this morning when I was given this honour. I said, you know, days like today, I'm so happy I'm Irish, because I think we have a great respect for storytelling and literature. Even this position of Laureate in an Oak, you know, it shows a willingness to embrace that culture and promote it. So when I'm talking to children, I like to talk to them about the fact that we are Irish. We punch way above our weight when it comes to literature. We have a fantastic legacy. And as I said also this morning, you know, whether your family can be traced back to Finn McCool or you've been living here for 3 months, this is your story. This is your inheritance. We are great storytellers.
Agus Kurt Fin Changa Fin or Janga Fin on Gwelige on will chef no one plan the got chimple na hotch shin.
Yeah, well when you on the clean sore over just egg cur your ingoiga us core on fubble. Agus Bualim Gulian Shishin Rai. Agus Gamech much Honodo Rikena a can't feel our ingoiga Agusato Emerla. Like we're incredibly lucky, Sean. We have two canons of literature for children in this country, one in Irish, one in English. So nobody is left out. And Anya did such a fantastic job bringing those books into the light again and saying to people, look, give your kids a book in Irish to read. We have both. And I know when I was growing up, the books we read were mostly from the UK or the US. Now we have this fantastic canon of work. It's a really golden age at the moment for children's literature here and illustrated.
What are the challenges with AI? We hear how artificial intelligence can do almost everything now for us and will in the future do almost everything. Can it write a children's book, do you think?
No, I don't think so. You don't need that kind of intelligence at all to write a children's book. I think you do need a heart and you need to have experienced life in order to write anything, I believe. So no, I don't think AI can do this. I think, you know, people, even people who start writing, think that there's a kind of a formula, and if you do this and you do that, but children will out you every time. And the books they love are the ones that are full of heart, full of emotion.
Yeah, they've got real intelligence as opposed to artificial intelligence, so they'll spot it. They'll spot it a mile off. What are the biggest challenges that you see in front of you in this period of time? Because we all want our children to read and to continue to read, you know, into their teens and into their adulthood. What are the biggest challenges in that respect that you want to address, Patricia?
Yeah, I think with all the best will in the world, we spend a lot of time telling our children not to daydream. We tell them to focus. We tell them to, you know, knuckle down and get on with it. And I think we need to encourage them to daydream, to be away with the fairies, to think differently and to be creative. You know, I think facing into what they're facing into and the future now as it is, you know, a future that is so uncertain, I think creativity is going to be the biggest weapon they have to deal with that. I mean, when you think about it, story's all about change. You can't have a story unless something changes. So if you train children from very early on to love stories, to embrace them, to write them, to make stuff up, then I think change becomes a natural thing. And instead of being afraid of things changing, we could have a whole generation that will embrace change. And I think they do that through being creative. And, you know, like I said at the beginning about Sauliacht, using their imagination, imagining themselves in somebody else's position, imagining what our world will look like in another 30 years.
Well, it does bring us full circle to that motto of yours that we got at the beginning. Sowly, sowly, making it up as we go along. Patricia Ford, Cogorgicus Arish, Patricia Agus Ganari Lats, Safos Nua.
Gurmil Magadihon.
Patricia Ford there, announced today as the 7th Laureate na n-Óg, Ireland's Children's Literature Laureate.
Ah.
and just coming up to, or just gone, 13 minutes past seven on Monday night, Serena. It is Monday night. It is indeed Monday night. Shooting a gig often feels a little bit like going into battle, says my next guest. He's photographed some of the great live acts, the Stooges, Sex Pistols, Sinead O'Connor, The Fall, Fontaines DC, and many, many more. Cormac Figgis's book of live music photography is called Shot From All Sides, and delighted that Cormac is with me in studio this evening. I suppose let's go back to your beginnings in music, first of all, Cormac, back in the 80s. How would you describe 1980s Dublin and the music scene that was there at that time? Because that's kind of your seeding ground, is it?
Yeah, it was. There were some interesting bands. I mean, it was ultimately kind of bleak, but there were some interesting bands around in the 80s.
But did the bleakness actually give birth to the great bands in some ways?
Yeah, I guess it did. It was something to do. It was an outlet. Mm. But I ended up kind of going to punk gigs in the sort of mid to late 80s.
And who stands out in your memory from that time? This is well before any of the photography started now.
Yeah, yeah. Paranoid Visions, really. Mm. They were the main reason why I ended up kind of hanging around that
the music scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you played a bit at one point along the way. You played bass, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've played in bands since I was in college, but I ended up playing with Paranoid Visions as well in the 2000s, which was
quite an experience to kind of come at it from that side. Yeah. I suppose that's looking at it from all sides, shot from all sides. The title of the book. When did you went to the National College of Art and Design? What was as a graphic designer? You qualified there as a graphic designer.
Yeah, well, I did my foundation year there, and then I went to Dunleary for 3 years.
And was graphic design the kind of the bread and butter? Was that it for a long time?
Yeah, it was graphic design and photography is what I did in Dunleary. Graphic design is the bread and butter, but photography is something that I've always had an interest in.
And specifically then, music photography, was there a moment? Well, I know there is a moment.
I've always had an interest in music, so it kind of made sense that at some point the two would meet.
For how long were you carrying a camera around in your pocket? You
know, I used to carry, back before digital, I used to carry a film, like an Instamatic film camera around every day, everywhere. So it inevitably came to gigs with me. Hmm. But shooting with a crappy little Instamatic, the good shots were few and far between.
But I guess you would learn a lot, because I mean, this was at a time, as you say, way pre-digital. Digital. So you couldn't just tick out whatever it was and click, 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 and have, 40,000 pictures when you went home that night and choose the half dozen that kind of worked.
Yeah.
Even with an Instamatic, I guess you had to learn a way of, when you were at a gig in particular, knowing what was going on at the gig, but also knowing what you were going to see through. And I accept it wasn't the best camera in the world, but it has a viewfinder, and that's what's going to end up on the piece of film that when you make the shot.
Yeah, well, if the opportunity arose, it was a case of just kind of shoving my way up to the front of the stage if I could. When I started doing it kind of in earnest with the New York Dolls shots, that was more a case of like getting a pass for the pit, if there was a pit, and actually being in there with the rest of the photographers, at the front of the stage.
And I guess having a camera that was a little bit better than your little pocket Instamatic.
Well, that first gig, the Dolls gig,
which was in 2006, wasn't it?
2006,
and that was here in Dublin. The New York Dolls were in Dublin.
Yeah, that was in the Village. Mm. That was shot with a digital pocket, like a small, tiny little digital Instamatic, I guess. Like it wasn't a very good camera. And I realised after shooting that gig that I needed to get something a little bit better.
What happened though at that gig? Because that you state in your own introduction into this that it really was a big turning point in terms of music photography for you. Was there something about that gig that kind of captured your imagination? It was just
chaos. The gig was absolutely packed, like it was over capacity, and I got there late, so it took me like 15-20 minutes to make my way to the front of the stage. There wasn't a pit, so I was right in the middle of the squeeze, and I was basically squashed against the front of the stage.
But there was a delight, clearly, in that, or there was something about the gig.
It was very exciting. It was very exciting. It was hot and sweaty and really loud.
When you got home then and started going through the shots, what was that? What was that experience like? Because it was digital, so you probably did have a few more than you had on your 16 or 24 exposure Instamatic.
I mean, there were one or two shots that I was like initially happy with. Mm. I didn't really think much of the rest of them were very good because of the limitations of the camera.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until I started going through them again for this book that I realised that there were an awful lot of shots there that weren't as bad as I had initially thought.
Yeah, so you were being a bit hard on yourself at the time. Yeah. However, I'm going to tweet an image now. It's really telling him. This is an image of Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
Really wonderful image. I'm flicking back to it in the book. I will tweet it as well, at RTE Arena, if you want to see it there. It's just so, obviously it's a still photograph, but it is so full of action. Maybe you could, can you remember the where and the when of this?
Yeah, that was the Electric Picnic.
Now, Electric Picnic, I'm looking at the site here, to 2nd of September 2007. So this is just the year after your New York Dolls experience.
Yeah.
So explain, you know, capturing an image like that. What's the balance between watching the gig? I often wonder this about photographers in particular. The balance between watching the gig and what's happening up on the stage, where you have to kind of get some sense of framing and watching. How do you do that?
There isn't really a balance. It's really hard. Like when you're watching a gig through a viewfinder, you're kind of missing everything else.
Mm.
You're missing stuff that's going on the periphery. You're missing stuff in the crowd. You're missing stuff on the edge of the stage. So you have to keep checking, and then you're risking that moment of maybe
that you'll miss the moment.
Missing the moment, yeah.
But I guess what you're not missing is the moment, like the one that is in this picture. It's the almost balletic pose that is in the picture that's so impressive.
Yeah, well, that's Iggy.
Do you remember, were there a number of images of that caliber? I mean, it's just he's so dramatic, even in that stance, and that look down to the audience, kind of almost as if he's looking to you with the cameras, almost as if he spots you there. Yeah,
of course he is. Yeah.
You know, is there some kind of moment of communication between like a performer up on the stage and you as the photographer in a moment like
sometimes
that?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, I mean, there are a few photographs in that book where the artist is looking directly at me.
Mm.
And I guess, I don't know. I don't know why that is.
But that probably defines a moment, does it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know.
If I'm quick enough to catch them.
Right,
for sure.
Oh, okay. Let's take a look. There's another aspect of the whole photographing a gig that I think is interesting, which is photographing the audience at the gig, or catching some part of the audience. Let's have a look at, this is The Misfits from Temple Bar Music Centre, 5th to 10th, 2007.
Yeah.
A big blue image, and we see Jerry, you know, out front. But it's the way you've captured the audience here. Now, it's from the audience looking up at RTE Arena, if you want to see this particular image. It's from the audience looking up.
Yeah, it's taken from the balcony.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. So you're kind of looking down at them, looking up.
Yeah.
Looking up at him. Yeah. Is capturing the audience a totally different process then, or feel to it?
Not really. You're just at a different level. I mean, when you're shooting up to a stage, you know, you're shooting at somebody who's like maybe 5 or 6 feet off the ground. Shooting into the audience is a little harder. It's basically just, it's blind shooting. It's holding the camera above your head because there's usually a sea of people directly in front of you. And just trying to capture, waiting for something and just hoping that you're capturing the moment that you want to capture.
So you truly are, it is, you're just taking a risk. You're watching the scene at the same level as the scene is happening, but the camera's up above your head.
It's above my head and I'm just shooting blind.
So you're hoping that you're not going to miss the half of the guy or the you know, the great shot of somebody up on somebody's shoulders that you're not going to crop them off the side. It's pure luck. Is there any way of kind of fighting against that luck element, or do you just have to wait until you get home and see?
Just have to wait until I get home. Yeah.
And would you, in a situation like that, you know, would you be working with a couple of cameras? Would you be working with a film camera and a digital camera, or is it purely film when it comes
to
these days?
It's just digital.
Right, yeah, so you can...
Just one camera.
So you can move your hand around, I suppose, in the hope that you'd get a kind of a landscape version of this. You'd pan around and take several shots.
Yeah, if I'm quick enough, I can take a couple of blind shots and then check the back of the camera to see if what I'm getting is like a decent approximation of what I want.
It strikes me, too, that, you know, some people, when, like, with Iggy, you're trying to... Iggy Pop, you're capturing, as you did in the image we had earlier, a kind of a balletic motion. Whereas I'm going to pull up an image now of Sinead O'Connor, and this again is from Electric Picnic in 2008. And the thing that's striking about Sinead, I mean, it's her face that we see there.
Yeah.
Opposite to Iggy, it's a stillness that you're kind of...
Yeah, very still. Very, like she's contemplating something.
Mm. She's looking down the barrel of the camera at you there.
She actually did look straight at me.
Mm.
And it sort of took me aback. And I hesitated just for a split second too long. And when I hit the shutter, she just glanced over my shoulder. But she looked directly at me for about a second.
Mm. Now, there's a strong sense of her looking at you and in this particular shot too. Again, I'm wondering about particularly in the stiller one, with the Iggy Pop one, there's a kind of a slight aggression in the look down. But with Sinead O'Connor's picture looking at us as an at RTÉ Arena, if you want to see that, there really is there's a real intimate moment between the viewer and the subject there.
Yeah.
What's that like for the photographer?
It's... When I'm in the middle of shooting, I'm kind of not really thinking about stuff like that. It's only afterwards when I get home and I've downloaded and I'm going through pictures that I see things like that, or that I register things like that. But most of the time in the moment, I'm just kind of working on instinct. I'm not really thinking about what I'm doing.
Yet you could remember from 2008 when we put up that picture of Sinead O'Connor, you could remember the moment when there was a direct...
Yeah, I do remember that.
A direct connection.
Yeah. But again, it was literally... I was just literally operating on instinct. Mm. And she took me sort of slightly by surprise when she looked straight at me. I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah. Most of the images that we've looked at so far have been... in black and white. The Misfits actually had a kind of a blue tinge. It was a colour photograph.
Yeah.
But I've Johnny Rotten up there now at RTÉ Arena.
Yeah.
This is a great shot. Where and when? Again, we're at Electric Picnic.
Picnic as well, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your memories of getting this shot.
Again, memories are hazy. It's just, like I said, it's just kind of working off instinct. And just... hoping that my brain triggers my finger at the right moment. The Sex Pistols were always one of my favourite bands. So, capturing a shot like that.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Iggy Pop one, where in Iggy Pop's case, the energy's right through the body, but in Johnny Rotten, because it is just a headshot here, all the energy is captured in the face and in around the eyes, the muscles, the tense, the taut muscles of that. The visual aspect of things, I think that comes from both your mother and your father.
My mum was an art teacher and my dad was an architect, but he also took photographs. He was, he was a photographer, but not officially a photographer. And he bought me my first camera when I was like 9, I think.
Which explains...
So there was always an interest there.
And that explains why you've dedicated the book to him, because the first camera came from there. Was it difficult? How many did you have to say, no, I haven't got enough space to put these into the book? Was it hard to make the choices?
Yeah, there's like 4 or 5 times the amount that's in the book that kind of didn't make it into the book.
Yeah, well, what's there is certainly well worth seeing. And yeah, thanks for coming in to tell us about them, Cormac. That's Cormac Figgis talking to me about his book. It's called Shot From All Sides. And Cormac will be doing a live event with John Robb, who wrote the book's introduction, by the way. And there's a great shot of John Robb in there as well, yeah, a bit further on. Great shot of him. And Gavin Friday. Great shot of Gavin in there as well. And that's at BIMM, B-I-M-M, next Thursday, June the 1st. Two sessions, one at 3 p.m. and one at 6 p.m. Ireland is full of sacred spots and holy wells. A 19th century survey stated that the country has no fewer than 3,000 holy wells, at least 15 of which are dedicated to St. Bridget. However, few compare to the one that is located at Liscannor in County Clare. It's one of the oldest wells rumoured to have healing powers. There's a pilgrim connection by land and sea to this St. Bridget well, or Dowoch Vrija, by the people of the Aran Islands, who traditionally visited the well on the 14th of August each year, making the journey across rather by boat. New exhibition, Dowoch Vrija, By Boat to Inis Éire, Pilgrim Exhibition, represents works by Francis Birmingham and Mary Fahey. Delighted that both Francis and Mary join me now from our Galway studio. Francis, maybe you'd start out by giving us a little bit of a history of the pilgrimage itself to this St. Bridget's Well, or Dowoch Vrija, at Liscannor in County Clare. It's made by the people of the Aran Islands. Just give me a little bit of the background to why they make this pilgrimage on an annual basis.
Well, at present, the date that they visit the well is in August. But there is some lovely accounts a little bit further back that it was because of the Festival of Lunasa, the beginning of the harvest. Mm. And there's a really nice account by Maura McNeil that they used to visit on the last Sunday of July and the first Sunday of August. And they used to make that journey by Curragh across and land into Doolin and make their way, I think it was about like 5 miles to the well, on their way. I suppose ritual was very important to them, the observances of the well and the practice of visiting the well, visiting the body of water. I suppose they were making the journey by land and first by sea. Mm.
And I wonder, like, are we talking about a practically empty island then on the day of this pilgrimage? I mean, was it men, women and children who were making the journey across? Was it quite a big populace that would make that journey?
I suppose we don't really know. We're very open to hearing all those stories when we bring our exhibition across to Inis Éire. That's what we're really curious about. So we're hoping to hear all these stories about it, because I wouldn't claim to be any type of a historian on it. And we're only working off what we hear locally. So, for example, I've heard through a friend of mine, Darius Balan, who would have taught me about the Brijo doll that they make for Bridget's Eve. For the 31st of January and to celebrate Bridget's Day. So I would have heard different accounts of traditions that connect us to the Aran Islands. And for example, I'm from Abinacmoy in County Galway, and we would have a very different tradition for Bridget's Eve. We would dress up like big glacier suits and go out and sing and dance and, you know, entertain for a few coins. So there's lots of lovely little traditions. So I suppose we're maybe feeding in our own memories of it, of our traditions of Bridget, and very open to hearing other ones.
Well, that's interesting, Mary, because the exhibition was shown in February of this year in the Clare Museum. So I suppose it's only right that you should be making the pilgrimage, if you like, almost in the opposite direction. And as Francis was saying, this will be about, is it about as much as anything to see and hear the stories of the people of Inis Éire in and around this this particular pilgrimage?
Yeah, for sure. There is a really nice account by Sean McMahona from 1942. He worked for the Irish Folklore Commission. And his account said he used to call it Crandove Sunday. So, you know, his account is in Irish, and he says the people used to go west to the well to listen to the Aran Islanders singing throughout the night and singing, I suppose, Irish songs. And having fires and lighting candles.
Right, well, let's take a look at the sort of materials, I suppose, that you have both gathered and how you've both responded to what you saw at the well itself. And I'll start with you, Frances. I'm actually going to just tweet a picture here, first of all, which is a picture from the well at Liscannor. It kind of gives us a sense of reference. This is like a passageway with all sorts of paraphernalia on the walls around it and further down. Maybe you'd explain what exactly we're looking at there at RTÉ Arena for people who want to see that. What is all the material that's on the walls and in and around the area?
I think they're called votive offerings and they're left by those who visit St. Bridget's Well. They place in the lair all these crosses and rosaries and scapulars and rags and found objects and things of your pocket or people with religious statues inside the topography of the well's enclosure. And I suppose it's to mark in some way some ritual or some intention or, you know, some kind of, I suppose, recognition of visits to the well.
And what's striking about that picture in particular is the amount of stuff that's there, yeah. Frances. I'm quite struck by that. I mean, this is obviously something that is done on a very regular basis because they're very contemporary. So, you know, there are pictures and things up there that wouldn't last very long before they just fade away. So this is done on a regular basis and these items are replaced and renewed on a regular basis.
Yeah, now we need to be clear that it's not just the Aran Islanders. I mean, there's a huge tradition of going to that well. And in fact, in some ways, it's become almost a tourist attraction. And I'd see buses stopping there. But I would have lots of friends who would say they're not religious at all. And they would go there because it is such a profound place. And if we think about these wells, usually they are pre-Christian Celtic sites or pagan sites that have been Christianized. So they're, I mean, if you saw from the picture there, Sean, it's a deep grotto. And when you enter it, you are fully enclosed by all these objects. And the grief and the loss and the pain and memory, just the dedication to all the, as one friend said to me, there's only grief because there was love. You know, it's the love of all these people that are being remembered, and it's mainly people's past relatives that are being remembered there, or maybe there's a prayer for a sick relative or a prayer for help. But it's a really profound place because you have this the rush of the water, you have the constant, you know, what you don't hear from that photo is the constant presence of the water, the well running through.
And I suppose, really, Mary, too, the other thing here is if you look at the tokens that are left at the St. Bridget's Well, that idea of grief and love, have the tokens that are left there, have they changed over time, do you think?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. You'd see stones with inscriptions, you know, permanent marker kind of. There's some very modern tokens left there now. You'd see baby soothers and basically, as Frances had that expression, things of the pocket. So if somebody arrives there and doesn't realise what they've just arrived happened upon, and then they find something in the car or something in their pocket and that's what's left there. So in lots of ways, it becomes very secular almost, the things that are left. But we're all connected by the intentions that tie us all together.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm going to tweet another of the images of the well, and this is a close-in picture that we're getting here at RTÉ Arena. We can see a set of blue rosary beads, little plastic rosary beads, very much to the fore here. Over to the side, there's a little like a little cross, perhaps a little Delft cross with little angel written in the middle of it. That tells its own story without, you know, you don't have
absolutely.
To. And yet in the midst of that, then there's just one of those wristbands. I can't quite see what it says on it, but it does. It not everything that is here has religious significance. Some of them are just ordinary items, Frances.
Yes, they are. And I suppose holy wells are, you know, they are one of the intangible cultural heritage items. That's like the practice or tradition or living expression of a group of people or in a community. You know, they show like through social practice, through rituals like visiting the holy well. And it's a living form of heritage. So that's why you see the modern items there. And this continues to evolve and change and adapt. I suppose they adapt their practice and traditions in response to their environment. So I suppose that's why you're seeing more modern items.
Yeah, and now, so we have the, obviously those pictures give us a sense of the actual well itself and the tokens that are left there. But you've also responded in your own art, both of you, to what you've seen there, and I suppose maybe inspired by some of the things you've seen there. I'm going to tweet an image now of a painting called Eag Fanacht, and this is yours, Mary. Maybe you could describe the image in Eag Fanacht and how that links into what you saw and experienced in and around the well.
Sure. I'm really drawn to the statues there. I think they're so beautiful, and beautiful because they're so weathered and faded and decaying, and there's the layers of plaster and paint are peeling off, and it really speaks to me about the passage of time and about loss and grief and, you know, the metaphor for life, really. And yet when I was painting that one, it was a mother and child, but the child, it was predominantly the statues that I noticed there are of virgin and child imagery. And the child is almost completely smothered and covered. At first, when I saw it first, I didn't even know the baby was there. They're almost completely covered by layer upon layer of scapula and rosary. And so actually what you see in that painting is almost the underpainting that I had done. And it looks almost like a brown cowl around the Virgin. But what you don't see are there were countless layers of entreaties and prayers and wishes and, you know, sadness and grief loaded onto that statue. So to me, I suppose, when I'm painting, I'm thinking almost like woman's work, and I'm thinking of how weighed down these statues are with our demand, not demands, but our prayers and our needs and our wants and our requests, you know. And I just thought it was an interesting metaphor for motherhood and for, you know, even the term Eag Fanacht, you know, waiting for the baby to grow up and waiting to for your chance and waiting to, as me in my case, to go back and work as an artist, you know, expand my professional practice. And I just really it really struck me, that image. So that's really the background to it. But I think as I was painting it, I decided to leave it, partly because some people are saying, stop, don't do any more to it. But it actually, on the right-hand side behind it, you can see almost these kind of rectangular outlines that are faded letters. And there was a very intricate, like there was page upon page of handwritten letter by one particular person. And it was just, you know, the pain and suffering. Obviously, I didn't read the letter and it's worn and it's faded. But it's just that is there. And just all the memories that are tied up together.
Yeah,
in
and
that
what particularly struck me about your painting is that, despite the fact that it is a painting, it has a real three-dimensional feel to it. You get that sense of the three-dimensional statue. Mm. Let's tweet a one of your works here, Frances. This is figurine dolphin bone covered in gold leaf on plinth at RTE Arena. To see this, maybe you'd explain the background to this piece for us, Frances.
I mainly use, I suppose, natural materials, found materials, and some man-made materials as well. But in this case, the plinth that it's on, it's actually from the shore, and it's actually a dolphin bone. My background is in marine, and so often come across lots of strandings and sightings, and I often kind of think the vertebrae of a dolphin, it looks like a figurine that you would find at a holy well. And I've been using gold leaf for a while now, 24 karat gold leaf. So it really is. It's kind of like an icon, really.
Yeah, and explain to me just the little blue section underneath the gold leaf, which really catches my eye.
Yeah, it's actually a modern piece of glass. It's not made by me, but it just sits nicely in there.
So you're a found objects type of person in some ways, aren't you? You do the foraging along the seafront and gather the seaweed as well.
Yeah, so I mainly use Ascophyllum nodosum, which is like bladderwrack or nottleneck. You might see it on the beach, on the shore. It's the air bladders that keep the seaweed up in the water. And they're very light and they're almost sculpture, really. Seaweed doesn't really... it's not a very needy material. It doesn't really ask very much of you. You've got no control about the shape or the form or the size or if it decays. And so I find it very easy to use in the absence of, using clay or...
Yeah,
it's already a vessel, really.
Ready for use.
Yes,
as it
is. And once you pierce the air bladder, when the little bit of nitrogen, oxygen disappear, it is like a vessel inside, and the inside is actually as important as the outside. You can slice it; it almost looks like a boat. It's kind of a closed material, really. It's nice to use.
Well, listen, safe travelling across the sea, as you will be doing, or I suppose you'll have to get over there some way, by land first and then by sea, I'm guessing, to bring the exhibition to Innes there. A safe travelling for that. That's Mary Fahey and Francis Birmingham and Dádhach Fhreidhe by boat to Innes Air. The Pilgrim exhibition will be held in the gallery at Áras Éanna on Innes Air, and that's from the 3rd through until the 23rd of June 2023, and you'll find full details on áras-éanna.ie. Historical dramas are nothing new to cinema, whether that's dramas about biblical characters, epic tales of Roman emperors, biopics around great historical figures like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, or figures from popular culture indeed, like the recently deceased Tina Turner, all provide ready-made, easy fodder for the film industry. But recently, a spate of films has emerged inspired not by historical figures, but by historical consumer products, specific brands. Air, telling the story of Nike signing Michael Jordan. Tetris, going to the origin story of the video game phenomenon of the early 1990s. Or even Barbie, starring Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling, trailers for which are currently bombarding the internet. John McGuire is with me in studio this evening, and he has been taking a look at this phenomenon and is going to tell us why it has emerged so strongly. That's your task, John. But before we do all of that, okay, you have coined a phrase, coined a term for this type of film.
Well, you call them biopics. I would call these brandopics, not Marlon Brando, but the brand. And these films are all about that corporate entity, that those interchangeable consumer products that we all know and that have been drilled into us through advertising and through branding for generations. And what's behind this current spate of brand-focused corporate sagas, and why are they proven so popular for streamers and at the box office? And first of all, Sean, I'd have to say you are free to make a film about anything, and everything. There's no limits to creativity, and I am certainly not the movie cops. I'm not deciding what's worthwhile and what's not. But, says he, and it's a bit of a big but, the recent run of these films, with the prospect of more to come, raises a question about the difference between a film and a piece of branded content.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, you know, to what extent, I suppose it depends on who's making it. Let's look at an example and see, is the story told with any kind of critical faculty where we're looking at it from all sides and all possibilities. Air is the one that immediately springs to mind. Just give us this is about Nike Air and Michael Jordan, one of the huge commercial sports relationships of all time.
It was a groundbreaking deal, this contract that Nike struck with Michael Jordan in the 1980s, in 1984, revolutionized sportswear and made Michael Jordan a very, very, already very famous. He was a rookie at the time, but he became a superstar, a global superstar. And Nike, who were struggling at the time and had dwindling fortunes in a very competitive market, made enormous advances. And that's what Ben Affleck does with this. The writer and director plays the Nike founder, Phil Knight, who at the urging of his in-house basketball guru, a guy called Sonny Vaccaro, played by Matt Damon, signed Jordan to this deal at the expense of other basketball players that they were looking at, bet the house on Jordan and won. And that's what the film is about, I suppose. But the film is also about the shoe. It's also about the brand. And, you know, we get used to establishing shots of office buildings and guys on the phone. That's what a lot of these films have in common. And what they're really celebrating isn't necessarily Jordan or really even the shoe. It's the deal. That's what's at issue. And if you look through films like Air and Tetris and even Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, let's stick with Air just for a moment because I want to
have a clip because it's a really good film. It's really well written, really well directed and well acted. That's not at the issue. The point is, why are they doing this?
Well, let's listen to Matt Damon as Sonny Vaccaro here. He's the scout for Nike. Wants to orient the company towards one man, and that one man is Michael Jordan. Jason Bateman plays the marketing director, Rob Strasser here, Nike's marketing director, and they're meeting the chief shoe designer, Peter Moore, played by Matthew Marr, and some of them, there's a lot of ego in the room here.
A lot of territorial.
51% of the shoe has to be white. NBA is extremely strict about it.
They'll fine him?
$5,000 a game.
We're fucked.
What about more red? A lot more red. And what about if we just pay the fines? Make a commercial out of it. You know, it'll give us headlines. They're going to fine Michael Jordan for being too colorful.
There you go. More red is what they want. So you're not debating here, John. John's term, Brando picks. These these films that are basically lionizing a brand. You're not debating about the quality of the acting, or even in this case, the quality of the script. So why does this film bother you? Is it kind of too pro-Nike, or what is the issue?
The entire subgenre, and I suppose if there's five or six films, you can call that phenomenon a subgenre. And they're about specific brands, and they arrive at a funny time, this kind of intersection of end-stage capitalism, where knowledge and information and memory and nostalgia in particular have become capital in and of themselves, and Hollywood's creative bankruptcy, where original films are considered too risky to produce in a market crowded with superhero blockbusters and the dreaded existing IP, that's intellectual property that's already succeeded elsewhere as a book or a video game or a TV show. And now to that, you have to take a stroll through the supermarket shelves, because all of that suddenly is fodder. IP. All of that becomes fodder as well.
Well, so I suppose the
audience, Sean, that has sat through 26 Marvel blockbusters is primed to sit through a film about breakfast cereal or crisps or runners or a child's toy or whatever it might be.
The other thing that we've seen in recent times is, you know, where, not just in recent times, but the whole transfer of a video game into an actual film. Now, Tetris wasn't quite that.
No,
it was something
exactly.
else. So explain what Tetris the film was.
Tetris was about a guy played by Taron Egerton, who was a kind of a low-level video game operative in the 1980s. He was buying and selling games to publishers and developers. And he glommed onto Tetris as a phenomenon in Russia, and then had to go to Soviet Russia, remember, in the mid-1980s, and convince the Russians to release this to Nintendo in Japan. And the film is about that battle that he had in Moscow at the time as an American, trying to make a deal that would benefit the rest of the world and not necessarily Soviet Russia.
And does this lionize the Tetris dude, the Hank Rogers character, who was the founder?
It's not quite hagiography. I mean, the character Hank Rogers isn't necessarily a good guy. He's out for himself and he's trying to make a deal. But what it does do is it positions the accumulation of something that is that became a global phenomenon, and it pivots it entirely on one guy, and that's where the lionization comes in. So it's all about Hank, and it's not necessarily about, and it's all about our awareness of Tetris, and particularly Nintendo and the Game Boy. But again, what these films have in common is that they are celebrating that aspect of capitalism, that the deal has to be made by a brave individual who is an iconoclast, who is willing to break the rules in order to get something done and succeed. You know, none of these films have any risk in them, because we know these are predominantly films from the mid-1980s. They're kind of Reagan films, and we know that they succeeded because we all know what Tetris is and we all know what Nike is.
Let's have a listen. The Tetris, I wanted to just listen to a clip from that. Taron Egerton, as you say, playing the character of Hank Rogers, discovering the game Tetris for the first time. Now, he's at a gaming conference in this. His assistant, Tracy, played by Mara Huff, has become addicted to the game being sold at another stand. And in between here, you'll hear Hank Rogers trying to sell the idea to his bank manager, played by Rick Yoon.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
Tracy.
Yeah.
Tracy. What are you doing?
How's it going? Look, I just invited this young lady over to see how our new game fares with the female audience.
Uh-huh. Sure. Come on, Tracy. I'm paying you to sell my game, not play other people.
Relax, Hank. This game's swell. What's it called?
Tetris.
Tetris. I don't get it.
It's a combination of tetra, Greek for four, all the game's pieces are variants of four, and tennis.
Tennis?
Tennis. Yeah, supposedly, the Russian inventor, he likes tennis.
Here, Hank, try it.
It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I played for 5 minutes. I still see falling blocks in my dreams.
So there we are, cutting between the gaming conference and the pitch to the bank manager, the two scenes playing.
The deal. It's all about the money.
And Hank is the big hero. Did people start looking for Tetris again and playing?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, you might not be able to answer this. Did sales of Barbie and Ken rocket after Margot Robbie and Robbie and Ryan Gosling played?
That's one you'd have to suspect. Yeah, but Barbie on its own as a part of Mattel, which is the corporation that owns and licenses the product, Barbie alone makes them $1 billion a year. So Barbie is a massive thing to begin with. I grew up in a Cindy household, so we had Cindy, the British variant. But Barbie is a massive thing. And like the endless aisles of some glittering hypermarket, there's more choice to come here.
So what about the film, and how does it fit into your Brando theory?
This is one of the summer's theory. Most hotly anticipated blockbusters, Barbie. The trailer has been a phenomenon. People are going mad for it.
I'm sure this is an old trick. Get people listening to and watching the trailer.
Exactly. Now, I haven't seen the film. I watched the trailer a couple of times and it looked pretty funny. And you can tell that Greta Gerwig is the writer and director here. And you can tell that this is a different prospect. Yes, it's about a brand. Yes, it's about a $1 billion brand indeed. And it is about a cherished childhood toy. So there are those issues of memory and nostalgia at play. But there is the suspicion, just going on the trailer, that there's something more interesting at work as well. Margot Robbie plays Barbie. She's transported into the real world from the fantasy world that she exists in. And she brings Ken, who's played by Ryan Gosling, with her on this journey. So it's a little bit of The Little Mermaid, that kind of thing is going on. But you have to say that there is an inversion there, that they are not just trying to sell you a Barbie doll, that they are trying to look at what that character means, what Barbie means.
And really. You're freely, but you are saying this is on
that
the basis
of...
there
is
of,
something. Yeah, again, I'm only going on the trailer.
On the trailer. Will there be much nostalgia around the BlackBerry?
I would hope so. This is a real-life corporate thriller, the BlackBerry.
Crisis.
It traces the meteoric rise and the sharp decline of what the now obsolete Canadian electronics communication device, which briefly thrived in that liminal space between the Nokia brick and your smartphone. And it's like the myth of Icarus tapped out on a tiny keyboard. These guys had the potential to be absolutely huge, and they crashed and burned. And so BlackBerry, yes, it is about this little device that some of us would remember. They're not going to relaunch BlackBerry on the strength of the movie. But what they are doing is they're trying to draw a line somewhere between what works and what doesn't. Can you find that moment in the market where something can succeed? I think what's most interesting, and it's further down the line now because they haven't even started producing it yet, is Unfrosted, the Pop-Tart story, which is Jerry Seinfeld's directorial debut. And he's written it, and it'll tell the story of how a group of Kellogg's executives came up with the concept of the Pop-Tart.
Now I want to go home and have three Pop-Tarts for my dinner.
And bring your
Barbies. Absolutely. Anyway, that's Joe McGuire speaking about, as he calls them himself, Brando Picks, films inspired by well-known consumer brands. And we will inevitably be reviewing the latest trend from Barbie to Blackberries on the programme at some point along the way.